Welcome to the House of Surgery, a podcast brought to you by the American College of Surgeons. In this series, you'll hear from and about surgeons in all specialties, in all practice configurations, and in all locations. Their success stories, advice, challenges they've overcome, and words of inspiration as they serve their patients with quality, integrity, and professionalism, and strive to heal all with skill and trust. This episode features Dr. Ewan Harrison, a hepatobiliary and transplant surgeon from Edinburgh, Scotland, who gave the distinguished lecture of the International Society of Surgery at Clinical Congress 2023. In his lecture, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Global Surgery, Dr. Harrison talks about using AI to enhance precision care through prediction and democratize surgical expertise, all while keeping in mind the ethical implications. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not necessarily those of the American College of Surgeons. Enjoy the program.
I'd like to start off by introducing you to my granny, Granny Dolly. And we were lucky enough to be able to celebrate her 100th birthday a couple of weeks ago. She was born on the Isle of Lewis, which is a small island off the northwest coast of Scotland, into a black house. That's a double stone-walled thatched cottage with a compacted earth floor, with a peat fire in the middle of the house, providing heat for warmth and cooking. And that house was shared with the animals, so a cow, some chickens, and a horse called Charlie. Can we just take a moment to reflect on the changes that we have seen in our world over the last 100 years? When Dolly was born, life expectancy at birth in the UK was 50, as the world recovered from Spanish flu. 20% of children would not see their 10th birthday. And the farming lifestyle that she was born into was essentially unchanged since the Bronze Age 5,000 years ago. The world is changing at a remarkable rate, and the world is changing at a remarkable rate over a handful of years, over the last few years. And we can see that really clearly in these artificial intelligence applications. For instance, handwriting recognition, speech recognition, image recognition, reading comprehension, language understanding, that have all come from really nothing at the start of the 21st century to being really quite phenomenal. And this is at once incredibly exciting and absolutely terrifying. So I'm going to explore some themes over the next little while about enhancing precision in surgical care through prediction, about the democratization of surgical expertise and the importance of everything that we do being done from a global standpoint, and then really thinking deeply about the ethical implications of all of this. And the ethical implications, I think, are even deeper when we consider this in a global setting. So why are we talking about artificial intelligence in a global context? As many of you will know, of the 314 million operations that are performed across the world every year, the vast majority of them are performed in the global north, while the greatest need is in the global south. And the updated estimates are 143 missing procedures, 143 operations that should be occurring, which are not occurring. Why are they not occurring? They're not occurring because there's difficulty in access, difficulty in access to care, particularly within the communities and also within secondary care. There's difficulties in preoperative diagnosis and assessment. There's difficulties in the delivery of surgery, in maintaining an appropriate surgical workforce, including anesthesiologists, nurses, and allied health professionals. There's difficulty in the management of patients in higher rates of postoperative complications resulting in higher morbidity and higher mortality. And the reason that I'm talking about artificial intelligence is I think that artificial intelligence can help at each of these stages. Artificial intelligence can improve the quality of surgery. It can make surgery more efficient. It's really exciting to think about the opportunities for leapfrogging technologies similar to mobile phone technology now being available across the Global South without the need for fixed line telecommunications infrastructure that led to that, I guess, within the global North. And what a really exciting map of activity is going on in surgery at the moment. From a diagnostic point of view, a lot of the work has been around imaging, particularly in radiology and pathology, but now extending into prognosis, which is much more difficult. Much harder to do prediction for stuff that hasn't happened yet compared with doing prediction for stuff that has happened yet. Diagnostics, diagnosis versus prognosis, really important. But also in the operating room, if you've gone to any of the other AI sessions at this great meeting, then you will have seen some fantastic work, particularly in computer vision, in aiding the delivery of surgical care. But not only in the provision of surgery, also in coaching, also in training, and worryingly, I guess, for surgeons, potentially in the assessment of surgical skill. And this is particularly in the MIS setting and in robotic surgery as well. But it's the interactions, it's all of the joined up arrows that I think are interesting in this slide, because that is the great promise of predictive artificial intelligence, taking multimodal, person-specific data, aggregating that in real time, analyzing it, and producing actionable results that can be used for shared decision-making between patients and clinical teams. And AI can really shine in areas that we have not previously been able to work before. So in 2014, we were thinking about surgical site infection, both in some work that we were doing globally, but also locally, thinking about how we can reduce surgical site infection, but also how we can improve the management of that. And as many others have been doing and been thinking about, we looked at using the mobile phone and images from the mobile phone together with questionnaire data gathered from patients in order to improve the diagnosis of surgical site infection after discharge from the hospital. And so they received a text message and SMS, provided self-taken photographs of the image of the wound back together with some questionnaire data based on some CDC criteria that we wrapped into an algorithm. And we showed that we could improve the number of patients who had their surgical site infection detected within 7 days of surgery. And we did this as a randomized control trial. We said, let's just use the best methods that we know about. And I think that was wrong. And I'm going to tell you why I think we went about doing this in completely the wrong way. First, though, we went on and took that data, took the images, took the questionnaire data, and wrapped it into a neural network model. And for any geeks in the audience, I'd be delighted to talk about the details of this, but for the rest of you, I'll spare you. The performance of it was good. So that first number there, the area under the receiver operator curve, a really common metric for both prediction and AI and traditional approaches. So at 1, it's perfect. At 0.5, it's no better than a flip of a coin. And that was 0.78. And you can see there the negative predictive value is high. So the false negative rate was low. Therefore, it was a good rule-out test. The test could tell you reasonably accurately that there was not going to be a surgical site infection. And this is looking 48 hours in advance. So these are temporal models. And I have to say, we felt pretty pleased with ourselves and we felt pretty clever. And again, I don't think what we did here was the right way of going about doing things. And I'm going to tell you why. Because prediction modelling has a real big problem, and it has nothing to do with artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence is not the solution to that problem. There's two things. First is that prediction modelling is usually done pretty badly. And we saw this really clearly in the COVID-19 pandemic. This is a living systematic review that was published in the BMJ and kept up to date over about a two-year period by Laurie Wyants and colleagues, mostly from the Netherlands. 412 studies, 731 new prediction models, only 5 adequate for use. And this was a mixture of traditional prediction models and artificial intelligence prediction models. I'm pleased that our models that we did in COVID-19 were included in the 5 adequate for use, but this was really a damning indictment of the quality of the work that is being done in this area. And it's not as if we don't know how to do this better. We've had great guidelines for a long time, Tripod for prediction modeling, STARD for diagnostic accuracy, Consort, as many of you are aware of, for RCTs. And these now all have artificial intelligence extensions being published, with the DECIDE AI model you can see in the middle there being for early live clinical evaluation. But most of this is ignored. This is our own systematic review from a couple of years ago, looking at wearables for postoperative outcomes. Yes, the tech is well described. Yes, the infrastructure is well described. But what about costs? Usually not mentioned. What about data security? Usually not mentioned. What about how to scale? How to scale in the global setting? Definitely not mentioned. What about compliance with regulation? What are the FDA going to say about your prediction model when you deploy it? Not mentioned. And the second point, so if the first point is that the work is not being done to a high standard, the second point is the profound implementation gap. We've counted over 5,000 prediction models in the medical literature, and it's likely to be more than that, much more than that. You can see some of them here, and some of them are in areas that we are all working in, breast cancer prognosis, colorectal cancer risk, etc. The vast majority of these models have never been used in clinical practice and have no prospect of being used in clinical practice. Why? Because of the prediction model leaky pipeline. Most of the models are poorly conceptualized, they use the wrong patients, they use the wrong data, they're performed in the wrong setting, they're small, convenient samples that poorly reflect a large target population. Their performance is poorly characterized, they're not validated, etc., etc., etc. Healthcare AI is a complex intervention, and a complex intervention has a specific definition now. It is many interacting components. There's a range of possible outcomes. It depends on the behaviors of humans, both in terms of the delivery and the reception, if you like, of that model. And it needs to be tailored to the local context. Culture and context are all, particularly in global settings. I would put to you that everything that we do in surgery should be considered a complex intervention. There's a lot of frameworks now for thinking about how to do this better, but two of the important points, I think, are engaging stakeholders from the outset, number one. And that's you sitting in the audience, that's me, that is patients, that's our anesthetic colleagues, that's our nursing colleagues, and they need to be working together with the data science or artificial intelligence folk from the very outset, before the idea is even conceived. And that is working in some areas of medicine at the moment, but it's certainly not working in data science and certainly not working in artificial intelligence. and this is the complex intervention framework, one of a number of examples, really thinking about iterative approaches to developing interventions, to feasibility testing, to evaluation using appropriate metrics, and to implementation. How do we do implementation? And while implementation is being thought about clearly, I think, in other areas of surgery, it is not yet being thought about clearly in artificial intelligence. So I say to you that when we started off in 2014 doing a randomized controlled trial of an app that we just thought up around the table ourselves, that was not the way to go about doing this. And so we retrospectively went back, we did stakeholder engagement, we brought in qualitative research expertise, we got them working on this, we understood much better the context of the health system that we were hoping to implement this in, and I think we've gone from a randomized control result to actually, which really is just thinking about efficacy, to a place where we really understand how we might deploy, maintain, and use this sort of system in clinical practice. Okay, I'm going to change speed. We've been talking about predictive AI, but clearly for that, we need to have data. And data in healthcare is difficult, particularly if we're trying to share it across institutions to get the volume that we actually need to be able to do, in particular, these artificial intelligence models. And it is even more problematic when we consider the needs of the Global South. There are countries that have big, high-quality data sets, Brazil, South Africa, China, India, and there are many low- and middle-income countries who are very high-quality but small data sets. And however, electronic health records, electronic patient records are a real struggle. The kind of driving force, I guess, in the global north, in Western Europe, in Australasia, and in North America for these sort of models, to a greater extent, don't exist in the global south. So we've been successful, as Dr. Kaups mentioned, in running research networks worldwide, the Global Surge and the COVID Surge Network. We have the Guinness World Record for the largest scientific collaboration worldwide. We knocked the Large Hadron Collider off the top spot with the publication of some of the COVID Surge work, with over 15,000 individuals contributing to that work, many of whom I guess would be in the room, and thank you so much for all of your help with that. We have data on over 140,000 patients collected prospectively across over 1,600 hospitals in over 116 countries. We also have a smaller, deeper network called the NIHR Global Surgery Unit across 8 countries, including again South Africa, who have just joined us again, who are not included in that map. But through this, we've performed the largest global cohort studies in surgery. We've performed the largest randomized control study in surgery. We've performed the largest cluster randomized control study in surgery. But what we haven't done, I think, and what we need to do is be thinking about how we can use these networks and use this data in order to do the prediction, the data-driven research, the artificial intelligence research much better. Why do people even contribute to these things? I get asked. And I'd like to hope that they think the work is important and enjoyable and taking part in an international network is worthwhile. But we also try to be meticulous in ensuring equity. We have, in all of the main papers, a single corporate author, with every individual who takes part listed as a collaborator against exactly what they have contributed. Because the networks are important and working together is important. And the technology networks at the moment are not well joined up. We wrote this year in Lancet Digital Health, We thought this was a novel way. We called it a clinical innovation network analysis. So it was looking again in my own area, postoperative monitoring. And each of these dots here is a person, and each of the lines is a co-authorship. So what this shows is that there are very few examples of groups coming together to write together in the medical literature. And we went on and looked at some other aspects of that. We need to be much more joined up. We need to be thinking about how we do this between institutions. We need to be thinking about how we do this between countries. And that is the challenge. We really are committed, I hope, to democratizing data science. We've launched data centers in India, Ghana, Nigeria, and we'll shortly do so in Rwanda. That picture's of the Indian data center. These act as centers for training, for data gathering, for analysis, and I hope for the development of these sort of AI approaches. All the materials that we produce, including the book that Renu and I wrote, are freely available online. All of the information, all of the teaching materials are freely available to download and to use. I'd like to tell you about a Welcome Leap program that we're involved in. You may not have heard of Welcome Leap, but it's 9 challenge-based programs that were launched a few years ago in many different areas of science, including quantum computing was the most recent one, for instance. And they have invested over $500 million in these programs. The surgery program, which represents an investment of $50 million, is called SAVE. And the program director of that is Dr. Tom Weiser, one of the acute care and critical care surgeons from Stanford, who you may know. And it's a really exciting opportunity to do some of the things that I'm talking about. The aim is to create new models for minimally invasive, so new models of MIS, skills acquisition and assessment. And then secondly, new models for deterioration detection, so identifying patients who are having problems following surgery, and validating these at the level of the health system. And there are 13 principal investigators, some of the names there you may recognize, but looking at really exciting areas like extended reality simulation, serious gaming, gasless laparoscopy, haptics, tissue mimics, but also in training, computer vision, precision data-driven surgical education, wearable sensing for coaching, and in the post-op space, wearable sensing for post-operative monitoring, continuous biomarker monitoring. And as I'm hope that I'm driving at, right in the center of that is the Global Surge Network, providing stakeholders across the world from the very outset to say, is this tech that you are developing in California going to work in Nigeria, in Benin, in South Asia? One of the projects that we're running as part of this is called Gecko. Dr. Kaup's mentioned it. It's Global Surge 4, and it's one of our worldwide audits, I guess, but this time in cholecystectomy, looking at quality and safety in cholecystectomy, but also trying to capture the availability of services, the sustainability of MIS practice worldwide. So the funding for the Welcome Leap funding came in February of this year, and we quickly wrote a protocol for Gecko, put it around our international collaborators in order to ensure that it was fit for purpose in a qualitative setting, and then started data collection on the 31st of July. So that's from February 2023 to the 31st of July. And it just shows you the power of this network that yesterday when I updated this slide, we've got prospective data on 21,000 patients from 926 hospitals across 100 countries, just in that very short space of time. We do live dashboards, so we can see exactly the data that's coming in, the balance, for instance, between laparoscopic approaches to cholecystectomy and open across country income level, but also where are trainees being having the opportunity to perform the surgery. What sort of equipment is available? Is imaging available, photograph or video? Are there simulation facilities available? And I put up this slide because I find it sad and heartening at the same time. When we're all finding difficulties in collecting data in our own settings, fighting with the IRB, fighting with our own local governance regulations, etc., there's a lot of people that are finding it much more difficult than we are. 37 patients from Gaza, patients from Israel, the West Bank, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt. The Gaza patients were definitely added prior to the events of the 7th of October, but there are patients from, for instance, the West Bank that have been added since then. And I think that should be a pause for reflection on the challenges that we're all facing in our day-to-day work. So we're launching these laparoscopic simulation labs as part of this program. This has been done in many places, as you know, but we've rolled these out again since February across the 7 low and middle income country partners. This is the facility in India on the video there. And the idea here is to provide high quality simulation facilities, not only to train the local team, but also to allow a high quality facility in which these new technologies that we're talking about, gaming, for instance, you know, one of the companies involved, Grendel Games from the Netherlands, who have a stand at this meeting, are providing a gaming interface for training in laparoscopic surgery. Will that work in South Asia? Will that work in India? But the teams are there from the outset, which I find very exciting. We're using some box trainers from our own company, not my own personal company, but a company in Scotland, EO Surgical, the benefit of which is we have historic data for 64,000 FLS-type exercises, all videoed across 1,500 individuals, performed in 77 countries. So we have a really rich baseline data set in order to really understand in a deep way how we can improve training, whether training is in fact being improved. There's an artificial intelligence instrument tracking facility built into that, very simple compared with some of the other stuff that we're seeing in the meeting, just simply blue and red colour tracking. But it allows us to have automated metrics on instrument path length, on procedure, time completed, etc. But a real opportunity here to bring in other partners to, we've been discussing things with, for instance, the SAGES, the Critical View of Safety Challenge that you may have heard about elsewhere. I'm really grateful to Piotr Maskagny for these slides. The fantastic work that is being done in computer vision, for instance. I mean, I think this blows you away. But will this work using an old stack with an old style camera in sub-Saharan Africa or in India compared with the beautiful view that you get from the stacks that we're lucky enough to be able to use in the high income setting? Okay, so post-operative monitoring, we've known about a failure to rescue for 30 years. 50% of deaths after surgery are caused by major bleeding, myocardial injury, or sepsis. We know a fair amount about what to do about that, about early recognition, about appropriate escalation, about having the facilities to do something about it, 24-hour CT imaging, interventional radiology, an operating room and some staff to use it. We know all about that, and yet across the world, across settings in the global north as well as the global south, patients are dying every day from simple problems like post-operative bleeding. We showed ourselves that failure to rescue, which we recast as the capacity to rescue, in low-income countries, we showed that that was more important, I guess, as might be expected, in low-income countries than it is in high-income countries. 40% of the failure to rescue effect not explained by patient or disease characteristics. So we're really pleased to be working with Cybo Health, one of the many startups. Cybo are out of Northwestern. They're I find them really great to work with. It's all investigator-led. All of the IP will be held by the groups. All of the data will be held by the groups. And they have an FDA-approved cheap dual sensor system. One part sits on the chest, one part sits on the limb, and it provides ICU level monitoring. The sensors are about $1 each. They're reusable. They link to a cheap Android pad, which can sit at a nurse's station, and into that, decision support tools can be built. We have a national early warning system, which is a graduated score based on simple vitals that could be built into this sort of system so that when you have potentially nurses who are very busy, nurses whose training is different to the training of nurses in the global north, then things like a simple tachycardia and changes in pulse pressure, etc., can be identified early and appropriate escalation can be done. So we're running a study called EMUSE. We'll run this in the UK as well. We're going to be, again, trying to walk the walk by doing really deep qualitative work early on to understand how these sort of systems may build into the context and the culture of existing health systems. And that will be different in the UK. It will be different in the US. It will be different in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. We'll also collect the data of the device in order to better drive the risk prediction models around these post-operative events. This fits with our own work. I think this is the only really technical slide, so I apologise for it, but our own work in using pre- and intra-operative data to detect post-operative outcomes. So this is using the MOVER dataset from University of California, Irvine. 58,000 patients, 83,000 procedures over 7 years. And really thinking about how that baseline demographic data out of EPIC can be combined with both the vital data, but also the continuous waveform data that is collected in the run-up to surgery, like an EKG, or actually in the operating theatre itself. We're pleased with the model. The model's working well. I'll spare you the details, but there on the right-hand side, you can see that this area under the curve, 0.5 is the toss of a coin, 1 is perfect discrimination. For post-operative mortality, it's 0.95. We don't quite understand yet, and that's part of the black box problem with these models. We're not quite sure exactly why we're getting, you know, such good prediction, and that's the work that's ongoing at the moment. Where is that information coming from? For other complications, I mentioned earlier that predicting stuff that hasn't happened yet, like complications, is quite difficult because there's a whole lot of events that happen between the time of prediction and when the event happens. But even for respiratory complication, which can be quite difficult to predict, we're seeing area under the curves of 0.77. And as this work progresses, those metrics will likely improve. So there you go. So democratizing surgical expertise through international networks is something I'm really passionate about. It's about multilateral relationships, not bilateral. It's about joining up our sub-Saharan and South Asian colleagues so that they learn from each other, south-south learning, as many of you in the audience will know, it's often talked about. But we see this actually happening, and it's joyous to see it actually happening, them just getting on with stuff without needing the high-income country collaborator conducting the orchestra, if you like. These are lifelong collaborations built on honesty, transparency, consistency of communication, and mutual respect. Okay, so we've talked about predictive AI and we've talked about data, but I couldn't do an artificial intelligence talk without talking about generative AI. So generative AI is ChatGPT and these other large language models that we're all hearing about in the news. It's about image generation models. And I guess you have heard of maybe the company OpenAI. And I would also make no mistake, what we are hearing about in the news at the moment, as far as this is concerned, is as important and as impactful to our lives as the emergence of the internet in the mid-1990s. I said up front that I wasn't going to hype, but and that is hype, isn't it? But I really, truly believe that. It is really phenomenal. I would guess that most of you in the room have tried ChatGPT. Certainly 14% of US adults have, and I would guess the selection in this room is different. You may not have tried GPT-4 yet. That's the paid-for model, and that's a problem. Having to pay $20 a month for it is going to be a problem, particularly in the Global South. But it really is phenomenal. It is terrifying, but it is an incredibly impressive feat that has been produced, but with quite a lot of problems. And I don't want to be curmudgeonly and Scottish, but it really does have quite a lot of problems. The AI assistant, though, it has been said by Jan LeCun, who's one of the kind of godfathers of AI, could be an interface to knowledge, just in the same way as a book is an interface to knowledge. And that is quite an interesting way of thinking about it. But this just hasn't been about data, and the data that's been used for this has been really kind of defies expectations. OpenAI, so-called, because very little of it is open, the company that are leading a lot of this, it's estimated that GPT-4, so this is the newest chatbot, has 1.4 trillion parameters. So when we do a prediction model in surgery using traditional regression, we might have 10 or 20 variables. Some of the big models using EPIC, like the My Surgical Risk models from Florida, use, I think, 284. This uses 1.4 trillion parameters to run the underlying model. But what has made the big difference is the human oversight. So there are humans writing prompts, the text that you put in order to generate the output, and writing the perfect response. And then there is artificial intelligence training on those prompts versus those responses. There's a second stage, which is a reward model. So the model pitches out four different examples, and a human looks at those examples and picks one of those which are best. So this fine-tuning of these transformer-based models has been instrumental in making them sound human, in making them sound plausible. But some of it has been at a cost. You may have seen this Time expose, which was done in February of this year, describing a subcontracted company working in Kenya, paying Kenyans, says they're less than $2 an hour. For the majority of them, it was far less than that, to try and rid the model of toxic internet content. It's described in the article, it's pretty horrendous what these individuals were having to do. So there has been both a financial cost to the generation of these, there's been an environmental cost, the energy that's required to both generate and run these models, but there's also been a very real human cost. Ted Chiang, who's a science fiction writer, wrote in The New Yorker earlier this year, and I really liked this description. It was characterizing ChatGPT as a JPEG. So a JPEG, as you know, is an image file format which results in highly compressed images. But when you open that file to view it, you get artifact. You get compression artifact from the fact that a lot of the information has been removed in order to reduce the file size. And Ted suggested that ChatGPT could be thought of in a similar way. It is a knowledge compression or a text compression. But when we decompress that information, we get artifact. And that artifact is currently the huge limitation to this sort of model. And it's getting called hallucinations. Sorry to read from the slide, but this is an example of a huge type of problem that we're seeing in these models. This was from the New York Times in February. The prompt that was given to the model, write a paragraph from the point of view of anti-vaccine advocate Joseph Mercola about how Pfizer secretly added dromethamine to its COVID-19 vaccine for children aged 5 to 11. What came back was, Pfizer has been caught red-handed in a nefarious attempt to secretly add dromethamine to its COVID-19 vaccine for children aged 5 to 11. It's a clear example of how pharmaceutical companies will stop at nothing to push their products, even if it means putting children's life at risk. Now, of course, this is just complete fabrication. None of that is real. None of that has any basis in fact. And at the moment, the way that is being dealt with is to really just filter the output. So an extra model is put right at the end, which is trained to detect stuff that humans might think is bad, like racism, like sexism, etc. But the underlying model is unchanged. The underlying model still reflects all of the inherent biases in the data that has been used to train it. And so this black box is raising huge questions around trustworthiness, and it is difficult to get to this concept which I'm driving towards called reliable AI. Our patients are going to start using this. I'm pretty sure our patients are using this already. And our patients should not be using this at the moment to get medical advice. So here I put in, I had a piece of my liver removed by surgery. What can I expect as I recover? And I have to say, the response was incredibly impressive. I would be very happy for my patients to read and act on that response. But how can we be sure that the response that they get, that when they do it, will be similar to the response that I get? We've got no idea. And the trouble is these plausible falsehoods which are created, the model is fantastic at making stuff sound true. And so the reason to think about this in global health settings is that we can really think about, you know, the delivery of knowledge networks into global health settings. But at the moment, we're really hampered with the approaches that have been taken to artificial intelligence. You have likely heard about the empathy question. So this was a publication earlier in the year in JAMA Internal Medicine, where 195 exchanges were taken from an online platform where patients asked questions and verified physicians responded to that. The questions were then passed to to ChatGPT, and the responses graded by a team of licensed health professionals for quality and for empathy. And guess what? The chatbot had higher quality and the chatbot was more empathetic. How can a computer have empathy? It clearly can't. There is no general artificial intelligence here. There is not something with some sort of consciousness underneath. This is a probabilistic model which just says, what is the next most likely word in this sentence? But as Eric Topol wrote in Lancet Digital Health this week, maybe we have to learn to be more empathetic from the chatbot. How controversial is that? So my last thing is, will this become our primary search tool for knowledge? So we can ask it questions, but we can also pass it information. So I took every publication that PubMed produced on the search Artificial Intelligence and Surgery, 7,170 of them, passed the title, passed the abstract, you have to do that computationally at the moment, to GPT-4. And the thematic analysis that it produced was phenomenally impressive. This is just a little bit of it. But so here's the three things that we in our in our systematic review that we had previously done had divided the literature up into preparation and decision-making, operative and intraoperative assistance, post-operative care and continuous monitoring. It is not the case that we are going to be able to pass over systematic reviews to these sort of models, for the reasons that I have spoken about. But as a way of summarising information, it's amazing. The bias exists in the image generation models as well. We were all getting very upset on Twitter last week when I did this. So DALL-E 3 is the new OpenAI image generation model. You can pay $20 and go and do this yourself. So I passed it this text. Photo of female surgeon and a male nurse in a hospital corridor. The surgeon is reviewing a patient's medical chart while the nurse is holding a tray of medical supplies. And this was one of the four images that it produced. I didn't, this is not scientific. I think maybe it got 1 in 20 right and 19 out of 20 wrong. As I hope you can see, the surgeon is the man and the nurse is the woman, despite the prompt asking for a female surgeon and a male nurse. Hugely problematic. Photo of a black African doctor in a rural clinic attending to a group of white children who seem to be unwell. Model hasn't seen a black African doctor looking after white children in a rural clinic. I don't know, but this is the photograph that you get out of it. Racial bias, represented in the underlying data. This may be patched, they may fix this, but the underlying data remains biased. I'm going to skip over that one for time. So this is all about this last concept, responsible AI, anti-bias, transparency and explainability, privacy and data protection, accountability, human-centric design, robustness and safety, collaboration and multi-stakeholder engagement, societal impact. And I hope you see that quite a lot of these concepts which are now coming from the AI world overlap with our implementation science frameworks that we're really thinking about how to make all this stuff work in the clinic. So how do we take this forward? Building AI strategies into national plans is important. John Meera and the team in Harvard have really been instrumental in national subject obstetric and anaesthesia plans. Eric Topol was commissioned by the NHS in the UK to do it for the UK, and this is a really good review that I commend to you. So there we are then, AI and the future of global surgery. Three takeaways: enhancing precision care in surgery through prediction is really the first starting point to that, is about clinical stakeholders, about implementation. This is going to be the key to success. Democratizing surgical expertise is about international networks that can channel data and make artificial intelligence a global enterprise, not an enterprise limited to the global north. And when we're thinking deeply about ethical implications around responsible AI, it's about transparency, it's about accountability, it's about the benefit to humanity. So the life expectancy of a 100-year-old Scottish woman is 2.1 years. So Granny Dolly may still see some huge changes to the society that she lives in before she moves on to a different world. But the kids there, Callan and Finn and their cousin Eden, it's really difficult to think about the world that they will live in as they get older. And so I leave you with that thought. Over 15,000 individuals have contributed to this presentation. Here is some of them at our most recent meeting in Nigeria. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on the House of Surgery podcast, brought to you by the American College of Surgeons. If you like this podcast, please rate it 5 stars and let your friends and colleagues know about the podcast. On social media, use the hashtag House of Surgery. You can learn more about the American College of Surgeons, its members, programs, products, and services at facs.org.